From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the California skies earlier this month. You've seen the pictures, and they have hardly looked real. The devastating fire sent blankets of smoke into the air, and it resulted in a sickly, dark orange cover. The middle of the day seemed almost as dark as night. Streetlights stayed on. People were concerned about simply breathing. Kids were scared to go outside. And it didn't just last for a few hours. The smoke was so pervasive that eventually, even when the sky returned to a typical color, the haze drifted all the way east to Rochester and New York City. Did you notice last week? We had 2 days that were supposed to be bright sunshine and blue skies. We had smoke haze. Slate.com described the scene out west this way, quote, "You know things have gone off the rails if people are arguing about whether it looks like Mars or Venus where they live," end quote. But as the New York Times points out, there are other warning signs from this summer as well. The Times writes, quote, "Last month, before the skies over San Francisco turned to surreal orange, Death Valley reached 130 degrees Fahrenheit, the highest temperature ever measured on the planet. Dozens of people have perished from the heat in Phoenix, which in July suffered its hottest month on record, only to surpass that milestone in August," end quote. University of Michigan climate scientist Jonathan Overpeck told the Times that what we're seeing now is just a small harbinger of what we're likely to get in the near future. And climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe says, "It's as if we've been smoking a pack of cigarettes every day for decades, and the world is now, finally, feeling the effects. And now just imagine what our kids and grandkids are likely to see." This hour, a conversation about what happened in those western skies, what it was like to be there, and what it means for us. Let me welcome our guests for the hour. Hello to Dr. Joseph Henderson. Joe's a lecturer in the Department of Environment and Society at Paul Smith's College of the Adirondacks. Joe, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Evan, how are you?
I guess I've been better. Okay, I guess
haven't we all been better?
You can't ask perfunctory questions like that when things are as weird as they've been. But I appreciate you being here, Joe. I appreciate having Allison Konecki, an arts professional and an avid camper who is a former Rochesterian now living out west. Allison, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And Alex Wegman is a writer and a full-time mother who lived in Rochester for a time, whose husband's a Rochester native. Alex, nice to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Joe, we're going to go in a lot of different directions this hour, and certainly we've got to spend some time with sort of the big what this means in all caps question. But I want to ask you if what you saw out west has moved the needle at all. Did for a few days, and now it feels like everyone's already sort of forgotten that. We had smoke haze in New York State, for goodness sake. Are we just kind of becoming numb to this stuff?
Oh, I mean, I don't know. It's hard to answer that question. Are we becoming numb to it? I mean, I think maybe the opposite is slightly true, which is that maybe for the first time, those of us here in the United States, especially those of us who are in positions of privilege, are now climate change is now visible to us in a way that it wasn't otherwise. I mean, you know, climate change and especially the things that have caused climate change have been visible to people on the margins of societies for a long, long time. And I think, and we can get into what some of those things are if you want to, but I think what's happening now is that it is becoming increasingly visible, especially for people who are in positions of privilege. And we can talk about that. But, you know, it was weird. Last week was really weird. Driving to work, I live in the Adirondacks. It's beautiful up here. The leaves are changing. You know, snow is on the way. And the sunrise and sunset the last couple of days have been beautiful. And in a weird way, you know, my students and I were talking about how really beautiful sunsets are often a function of pollution in the sky. And it was interesting to be connected in that way to the people out west. It's not necessarily a way I want to be connected to the people out west. And so I think there's, I don't know if we're becoming numb to it. I think we haven't fully dealt with or grappled with the implications of it. So maybe that's a conversation for.
No, actually, I'm really grateful that you continue to press the point to me, because sometimes I become a cynic and I don't want to be a cynical person. I want to be a realist. I don't want to be cynical. And you have repeatedly pressed the point that no, we're not necessarily normalizing this. More and more people are seeing it and feeling it. Though you did just ruin sunsets, so thank you. You will always be the guy who ruined beautiful sunsets. So, Dr. Henderson, Thank you for that. I mean, in a more serious way, that's a great point. And it is something to consider why we see, you know, the colors we see and what's going on in our environment, what's going on in the planet. And I want to ask Allison and Alex about their experiences. But first, I want to play just a brief interview I had a chance to do this morning with another former Rochesterian, an author who moved out to San Francisco, an avid hiker who's always in the mountains. Allie Larkin was one of the first to reach out to me to say, people in the East just do not know how serious this is. And so this was my conversation with her just this morning.
Right now we have amazingly clear air, and it's something I really appreciate now.
Well, how long did it take to get to that point? Take me through when things started to change.
We had that lightning storm, and I can't remember. It seems like a lifetime ago. And a couple of days later, the smoke started getting really bad here. When it got terrible was September 9th, which is the day where you probably saw pictures of the sky turning orange here, like in the middle of the day.
Yeah, yeah.
We actually woke up and the sky was like a funny yellow color. I thought it was still night. And at 9 o'clock when I went to take my dog for a walk, the streetlights were still on because everything was so foggy and hazy and smoky that the sunlight couldn't break through at all. So the streetlights never went off. And then it started getting darker from there, and the air quality wasn't terrible. It was actually okay to go outside, but the next day the air quality just started getting worse and worse and worse, and it was all trapped under the marine layer.
What did it feel like? Yeah, yeah. When you were outside, when you talk about the air quality, what did it feel like?
I'm really careful. I try not to go outside much when it's bad because I have asthma, but I went and ran the dog outside, like your eyes start stinging, your nose hurts. My airways are still irritated from the time that we had, just from the little bits of time that I went outside. But the other thing that happens, like houses in California aren't made to fortify against nature the way that the house in Rochester is. So, you know, we don't have to hold heat in the same way. So I was duct taping at parts of this house that we live in, you know, like duct taping the ceiling fan and some of the doors shut when I came back inside because the smoke would just leak in. There was one night when the fires first started where I got up in the middle of the night, went to the bathroom, and there was just smoke pouring in from the ceiling.
My God.
You know, it's terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, do you get the sense having, you know, you're from Rochester, you've got friends here, you know people across the country. Do you get the sense that people who don't live out west don't truly know just how disconcerting this was?
Yeah, it's hard because you just really want to tell people, and it's hard to feel like other people aren't understanding what you're going through, that it's not just a little bit of smoke. It's that, you know, it was September 19th or September 9th when the sky turned orange, and it was September 15th when I could walk my dog again. And even then the air wasn't great. And our whole lives were just around that and feeling trapped and feeling like we couldn't go outside and not knowing when it was going to get better. And we were well into, I think it was, you know, probably September 12th or something when a friend from New York sent me a message and was like, I heard about the fires in California. Are you okay? We've been going through it for such a long time by then, which just felt like we were being left behind or something, that, you know, nobody knew what we were going through.
Well, how frightening was it for, I mean, everybody sort of has their own experience with it, but, you know, when you were talking to others who lived out there, you know, whether their kids were scared or they were concerned, how seriously concerning was it? You know, what was the kind of the mindset of people who were kind of near you?
We've been through this before with some of the other fires, but not at this level. And when it got really bad after September 9th, I noticed that everybody got really uneasy. We started to get panicky. You know, you're trying to keep it together. You're trying to keep it together. And I think it was maybe September 13th, we all started to break and started to talk about, how do we get out of here? Where do we go? I remember looking at the fire map going, is there going to be a point where we can't even drive out of California? Because it seemed like all the fires were at the border. And it just, you didn't know if it was ever going to end. And the fires in Oregon were getting worse, and it was terrifying. And people with little kids, they can't explain to their kids why they can't go outside. It was, you know, my dog would go over to her leash and look at me and start crying, and I couldn't do anything about it. So, you know, there's not much you can do when nature takes over like that. You just try to keep it in, but it bubbles up, and it's constant maintenance to deal with that fear.
Well, and let me conclude with this, Allie. Do you have a concern that people will sort of get numb to this and sort of start to act like this is normal?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think because we've already had what they are now calling mega fire events, because we've already had a few, you start to think, oh, it's fire season. We started talking about fire season, and that's kind of upsetting. A friend of mine who grew up in California, she's never seen fires like we've had in the past 5 years. She didn't grow up with this. It's not normal, but we've already started to normalize it. And that's really terrifying. And it's really scary to feel the effects of climate change so directly. I know that some people aren't taking it seriously at all, or don't even believe it's happening. It would be really nice to not believe it's happening. It would be really nice to not have been in the middle of the effects of it so severely, but it's real and we have to act like it is.
That's Allie Larkin, an author with Rochester roots, now living in San Francisco. And Joe Henderson, you know, when she says it'd be, you know, nice to be able to pretend away that it's not real, but it's real, and it's terrifying to be in the middle of an actual climate event. You know, you have been tough at times, Joe, on the media and the way the media reports and discusses climate. And already we've seen certain commentators, conservative commentators, saying you can't say that what happened in California is a climate event. I mean, what do you want the media to do with events like this, especially as we help people try to understand their world that's changing, Joe?
What do I want the media to do? I mean, I think you're doing it right now. I think there are some media organizations, I'm thinking specifically of the New York Times, which has actually been really, really good on addressing climate change issues. Centering it as the with the seriousness that it deserves. I do think that there are places that are doing this, probably not enough. And you know, it is the fire ecology of California is actually complicated, and has roots that go back to colonialism. So I mean, there's a lot we can talk about how complicated that specific issue is. But I think overall, we know that climate change is making extreme weather more extreme. And so I loved Allie's comment there where she said something like, you know, it would be nice, or something like, it would be a privilege to be able to be a climate science denier. And, you know, climate science deniers generally are a pretty privileged group of people. And so it's, you know, that's those dynamics are kind of all playing out here. And the media, I think the more you can focus on the urgency of the issue and how it's actually impacting people's lives, especially marginalized people, that is that's kind of crucial service. And, you know, really digging into if we had I know Evan that this is kind of how you operate, but it would be nice if we had journalists that actually kind of spoke truth to power and weren't just you know, more interested in going to fancy cocktail parties with politicians. And I think having oppositional media who are taking on people in positions of power, especially those who are making climate policy, would go a huge way towards really informing the public about what's going on.
For listeners who are tempted to email me with a conspiracy theory that's been making the rounds, I've seen it. I know that there is a map that people have made of the fires that were active in early September, and amazingly, they stopped at the Canadian border. And the idea was, see, Canada didn't have any fires, and this was either intentionally allowed to happen in the United States, or it was just mismanaged by West Coast governors, and it wasn't driven by climate. Well, it turns out that those maps were generated by American tracking services, and there are fires in Canada. Doesn't mean there are as many, and there's a complex set of reasons: topography, management, weather events there, rainfall, etc. But there are fires in Canada. Those maps were, it'd be like saying, hey, here's a map of COVID cases, and apparently there's only COVID in New York State. This was a conspiracy led by the governor of New York State to perpetrate COVID in his state, but the other governors haven't done it. Well, that's a New York State COVID map, so we're not tracking Rhode Island. So please don't send me that map. That's all I'm asking listeners. Please don't. Allison Konecki, can you give me a sense for, you know, what life has been like for you? We heard Allie's story. Why don't you take me through your story and let our listeners know where home is for you out there?
Certainly. Like Allie, I live in San Francisco, and hearing her comments about that apocalyptic day certainly resonates. And I know that word has been used a lot here, but if there was ever a time to do so, that day certainly felt like that. I woke up and it was still dark out and went outside, and indeed the sun just never came out that day. And it was, I was just reminded that we as humans are animals. I reacted very viscerally and just was like, where's the sun? I knew intellectually that it was smoke related and fire related, but it was just an interesting reaction that I that was just pretty stunning. So and then since then the smoke settled in again that day. It was odd, the air quality was fairly reasonable, which was surprising. But then after that, the smoke really settled in, and it was, yeah, I think about a week before we could really go out and do anything. And I'm a runner, you know, I couldn't go out running, live in a small apartment like many San Franciscans. And with COVID, it just felt like a world that had already gotten small, got much smaller. And I will say in general, you know, I'm pretty lucky to live where I do. We get, I live close to the ocean, so often there's an offshore breeze that keeps smoke at bay. So in general, pretty fortunate. But for sure, this season, it's hit extremely close to home. And just like you were saying before, I think people who don't experience it firsthand, it's really hard to wrap your mind around. But this fire season in particular has just driven home that we really need to do something, and this is a big problem.
And Allison, you're someone who has also done quite a bit of writing about a number of subjects, often about your travels, your time in nature, the times that you spend outdoors. I mean, it's a big part of your life. So obviously you're someone who understands before September 9th, you understood the risk here. But do you get the sense now that this can be a galvanizing event? I mean, is this an opportunity to grab more attention and more momentum to get people thinking about what's going on and to make change? Or does it feel almost intractable? Does it feel like, you know, what have we done? It's almost too late. What are the emotions you sense there?
Sometimes it depends on the day. In general, though, I'd say I tend to be an optimist, and I do think that there's usually a turning point. I think this this year has been full of turning points, but I do feel like this could be. I think really people are witnessing this in different ways. Like the fact when I heard friends from home and family saying that haze had drifted all the way over to that side of the coast, that's crazy. I think it is. And maybe it's good in the sense that people are realizing the magnitude of what is happening. But I do think that this could potentially be a galvanizing moment. And I'm hopeful that if some good could come out of that and change some hearts and minds.
It actually even sounds beautiful where you are. I mean, I'm hearing birds. what was it like when you saw blue sky for the first time after the orange had set in? I mean, were people almost standing in outside cheering when the sun came up for real?
Absolutely. That day, I went out for a run, and it was foggy and misty. And normally that's, you know, not my favorite weather to run in, but I relished it. I wanted that clean air that, I saw others, the same thing by the beach, just taking it in. And, for sure people were, extremely grateful to have breathable air again.
Sure. And incredible. I don't mean to get all sort of existential, but I don't think, Allison, that human beings do a great job at understanding and thinking about timescales. And I'm I'm in that category with most of the billions of us on the planet right now who think that the long run is the next decade. You know, and when you think about a long time, it might be 25 years. We need to be thinking in much bigger timescales if we're going to be serious about this. As much as of an optimist as you are, you want to be able to breathe that air, and you want future generations to be able to enjoy a run and a hike the same way you do. Do you believe right now that we're going to? There's no problem to conquer. I mean, there's not like an end game of conquering this. But do you generally feel that we're going to create a sustainable enough world where we're not all that close to the edge?
Well, I think that maybe the problem with getting support around doing something about climate change is because it feels like a really difficult thing to wrap our arms around. I mean, we have the science there, so I won't even get into that, why sometimes people are denying the science. But I think it is just hard for people to see how their particular daily actions really can impact things down the road, and also like bigger things like policy changes, and how just in general with policy, we as individuals sometimes feel powerless to affect the change that is needed there. So I do recognize those problems and think that that is certainly a big issue that we just don't see how it can have ripple effects into the long-term future.
Let me bring in Alex Wegman. Alex, can you describe what life has been like for you and sort of set the scene of where you've been? Because your situation was a little different than Allie and Allison. Go ahead.
Yeah, I live in Boulder Creek. There's a plane flying over at the moment. I'm sorry for the noise. I live in Boulder Creek, California, which is one of the towns that was evacuated in the CVU fire. And we lost around 1,000 structures between August 18th and I don't know when they contained it enough that we weren't losing them anymore, but it was into the first week of September, I believe. My family was camping in the Sequoia National Forest, and we didn't have any service, so we didn't know about the evacuation until we just happened to go and connect to Wi-Fi so that I could meet a writing deadline. And then my phone lit up with 40 text messages from people who were concerned because our town had been evacuated 24 hours prior. We had not been responding to calls or messages. It was a wildly emotional experience. The reports we were hearing at first indicated that our house had probably already been lost. So we left our camping trip with our two small kids. My son is 2 and my daughter's 4. And we were in our Sprinter, like converted Sprinter camper van, without any other vehicles and without anything besides like 2 days worth of camping clothes and equipment, and thought all our worldly possessions were gone. we didn't get confirmation that our house was definitely still intact and had been defended from the perimeter of the fire. It literally goes right around our yard. Until that was August 18th that the evacuation started. We didn't get word that our house was standing until August 22nd, wow. I believe. So it was a very, very scary 4 or 5 days. And then there were spot fires starting pretty much constantly. And so we were just kind of keeping an eye on the heat maps the best that we could. But there's no official channel for information about your residence, your dwelling, until FEMA can get in and do evaluations. So the best we could do was, you know, hear anecdotes from neighbors who had kind of gone rogue and hadn't stayed out of the evacuation zone, or new firefighters who had gotten access to cell service and could let us know what was happening.
Doesn't mean, even though your house was intact, didn't mean that it was immediately livable, right?
Yeah, we're still not home.
You're still not home.
No, we left home to camp on August 18th, and we have visited the house 3 times to do damage assessments and to collect some of the things that we know we can clean and use ourselves. But we have like toxic soot and ash, and it's just very smoky. It doesn't smell like a campfire. I've never been through a forest fire where homes burned down. I've never been through any forest fires, but I've never been in a situation where I've smelled what the after effects of a home burning are. And the next street up from us was pretty much eviscerated. So we have an extremely like toxic chemical smell in our house. We can't spend more than 10 or 15 minutes inside without getting headaches. And it's pretty uninhabitable at the moment.
What are your kids, the 2 and 4? I mean, 2 is 2. 4, I mean...
Yeah, he's oblivious.
blissfully, I can imagine. But 4, I mean, is there any understanding or sense of what's happening?
Yes. I have a very, very sharp 4-year-old. I'm way over my head with her. And the way we found out about the fires was... it was a pretty traumatic situation. Like we were sitting in our van. I was connected to Wi-Fi. I was kind of reacting in real time to the messages I was receiving. And we were camping with friends who live in the mountains near us. So they were also getting information from family. And my friend came running up to the van window and she had more information than I did. So she just kind of told us what she knew. So my daughter heard all of that. And, you know, there was no way to prevent it. She would have known anyway. She's just too smart to miss that stuff. So she was very worried about her stuff. She was really worried about her home. She wanted to know about her dolls and her clothes. There were a lot of things she had wanted to take camping that I didn't let her. And she was instantly, you know, thinking about her precious things, you know, at 4, like your whole world is like what's in your house, especially in pandemic world where, like that's your only environment. This was, and we left home for an overnight since February. So it was. It continues to be a very traumatic experience for her. She will have outbursts, and then we kind of investigate what the cause is, and it turns into like a big sob fest about missing home and wanting to be home with her things.
Mm. Talking to Alex Wegman, Allison Konecki. We heard from Ellie Larkin, 3 with Rochester roots who are now living on the West Coast and have been dealing with the effects of these fires, the smoke, and some of the macabre scenes. Where were you when the sky turned orange 2 weeks ago, Alex?
We've been taken care of very well by friends out here. And a retired couple that we know offered to go to Seattle and stay with their daughter if we wanted to move into their house for a few weeks while we waited to figure out what was happening. So we were living in downtown San Jose in a, you know, 4-bedroom house with a pool. It was like the best situation we could possibly be in. But the day that the sky turned red, we had to go to our home in Boulder Creek to meet with the insurance adjuster. So it was really interesting to drive from the San Francisco Bay Area into the mountains and see how the sky changed. In the higher elevation, it was much darker. So we went inside our house, and we didn't have power yet at the house. That was on September 9th, I believe. So we went in with flashlights at 2 p.m. so that the adjuster could try to take pictures of the damage. It was not the best conditions for getting our stuff covered by insurance. Mm. It was a really, really strange day. And then we went and sat in the home of the other family that we'd been camping with. They lived south of us in the mountains, and they were able to get back into their home maybe a week after the evacuation and didn't have any damage. So they're back living at home again. And we just sat and like watched the sky get darker and darker. When we left their place at maybe 4 p.m. to head back to San Jose, it was pitch black outside. Like it looked like it was the middle of the night.
Mm. Wow. Real briefly, let me just ask Alex and Allison, and then I want to turn back to Professor Henderson about a number of things here. But I've got some feedback flowing in here. Don says he appreciates the nod to how complicated the fires and the smoke have been. He says it makes sense to me that these fires have to do with climate change, but also forest management policies or even invasive species? And is there any way to tease out how much each contributes? Is that worth doing? I think the first answer is obviously yes, it is worth doing, because what we want is the best information we can possibly have about why these things are happening. And I don't know. I mean, Alex, is there dialogue among Californians about the management, the forest management, as at least a contributing factor? Is there a way to mitigate this at all? How is that being discussed?
It's definitely being talked about. I'm most tuned in with the mountain community, and our town is population like 5,000. It's a very small town. There's a lot of talk right now about defensible space, which is, you know, kind of cost of entry for living in the mountains. And it's something that we've taken seriously since we've lived there, but not everyone does. Waste removal and things like that also play a huge part. And then I'm hearing more about working with indigenous groups on understanding how to do more strategic controlled burns on a like smaller, more consistent scale. And yes, there is talk about just general forest management not having been sufficient up to this point.
Okay. Allison Konecki, what are you hearing? How do you see this issue?
Similar to Alex, just hearing a little bit more about how there can be some different approaches, more indigenous practices. For a while, there was histories of fire suppression. I can't obviously speak too much about that, not being in forest management or a scientist, but you hear that was the practice for many years, and realizing that was just creating more undergrowth and brush that would cause wildfires to be even worse. And so just what practices we can do moving forward and thinking about managing and doing controlled burns and such like that.
Okay. David writes to us from Vancouver, listening on the WXXI mobile app, and says that they were saved by the rain. He says it's even raining hard right now, and he says he very, very much hopes that it's raining over any fires left. Dave says Vancouver and much of Western Canada got very, very lucky this year. So fair enough. Joe Henderson, though, when we look at what's causing these, obviously it's a complex mix of factors that will cause it. But one of the points you made earlier this hour, you're still going to have to compete, Joe, with people like Kevin Williams. So Kevin Williams is a local meteorologist, still does a lot. Mike writes to me and says, Evan, you should interview Kevin Williams, and he will set you straight. Every morning I hear him do his weather chat, and he tells us this is all normal stuff and not to worry. Well, Kevin has blocked me on most platforms. He seems like a nice enough guy. I have no personal issue with him. But Kevin is not a climate scientist. He's not a paleoclimatologist. He hasn't drilled for ice cores, hasn't traveled. What he studies is day-to-day and week-to-week weather, which is not climate. The weather can be impacted by the climate or exacerbated by it. We're still dealing with this, Joe. I think we're dealing with it less. How much do we need to be sort of interviewing the different layers here of what's happening in California, and how much do we still have to grapple with this idea that, well, my weatherman said this is normal?
I don't know. I mean, last time I was on your show, I was talking about a book that a bunch of us had written on teaching climate change in the United States, and I mentioned that we didn't even really address climate deniers anymore in
that
book.
Right.
I personally don't spend much time entertaining climate change deniers. I find them to be malicious in their intent. I don't think they're honest people. I think that they are primarily motivated by political ideology, which is what the research shows. I don't know that you need to entertain it. I mean, you have a platform. You get to decide who comes and goes on your platform, and that's something you need to think about. But, you know, as I was listening, these stories are so painful to listen
to.
Yeah, they are. And I'm just, you know, I wrote down three words. I wrote down, I can't breathe. And listening to those, I was just thinking about the coronavirus case. The what we're going through with coronavirus, our utter inability to deal with that, our utter inability to deal with wildfires, our utter inability to deal with racial justice issues in this country. And I was just thinking, what a brutal society this is. And I try to be optimistic on some of this stuff, but I mean, we're clearly as a society totally fine with people suffering and dying. And I think that if there's anything that gives me hope these days, it's that young people specifically are pushing back against elders that don't seem to care whether they live or die. And, you know, California is such an interesting place on a number of levels. I mean, the way fire ecology has evolved, the way colonialism in the late 1700s impacted the land. It's interesting to hear that they're going back to indigenous technologies. I mean, we can talk about climate change as an artifact of colonialism, which it surely is. But, you know, look at California's elected officials. You've got Nancy Pelosi and Dianne Feinstein. Dianne Feinstein, you know, these are people who are members. I jokingly use the term kind of gerontocracy, right? Like the last time I saw Pelosi or Feinstein in the news talking about climate change, they were kind of talking down to youthful activists who were asking them to please take the issue seriously politically. I mean, I don't know if you want, like, it's there's just so much suffering that is happening now and happening in places where there didn't used to be suffering. But I mean, let's be clear, right? Like climate change and especially the causes of climate change, people have always been suffering in terms of the causes of climate change. I mean, Google images of oil pollution in the Niger River Delta, or the wars that we've fought over resources, or look at, you know, the colonized areas in Appalachia where, you know, oil and gas development occurs. I mean, there's people who haven't been able to breathe for a long, long time. And I think it's in terms of politics, right? And like it's now starting to be visible, and visible in a way that it wasn't in a kind of wealthy country like the United States. Whether it changes our politics, I don't know. I mean, I'm at the point where I think we're going to need some sort of kind of massive political movement if we're going to ever do anything about this.
Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, we're going to talk about climate migration, and I think we still have the congressman on. Congressman Joe Morelli is going to be on this program, and before I go to break, I'll just ask Dr. Henderson. Then you talk about speaking truth to power. Climate migration will be an ongoing challenge for the whole of the world now. But in the spirit of speaking truth to power, what do you want to hear from the congressman when he's on the program tomorrow, Joe?
I mean, I would like to hear, when I think of climate migration, right, I think of, you know, Donald Trump largely has no climate change policy. His climate change policy is his immigration policy, which is, you know, keeping peoples who are largely, in many ways, fleeing climate unstable areas now from entering this country. And so what is Morelli going to do in terms of immigration policy to this country? What is he going to do for the people who can't afford to migrate? I mean, I read a scholarly article the other day that said something like within the United States, as certain areas become uninhabitable, it might actually be beneficial for places like upstate New York because people will be moving back to places like Buffalo. And I read that and I thought, as a social scientist, well, what about all of the people who can't afford to move? What about the, you know, the people in poverty who that won't apply to? And I think it would be interesting. I would like you to ask Morelli where he's at on something like the Green New Deal and whether that goes far enough. It's not even clear to me that that goes far enough these days. I don't know. I don't follow Morelli's kind of politics, but there's big tensions within the Democratic Party around how seriously they take this issue, even though if you look at some of the recent news, it's now the dominant issue among Democratic voters. So I don't know. I would like to know the answer to that from the congressman.
Well, he'll be on the program tomorrow. Abram Lustgarten, who has contributed to New York Times and ProPublica, will also be on the program with us. And I've got to get our only break of the hour. We'll tell you what else is coming up tomorrow. And then we're coming right back with our guest, Dr. Joe Henderson, who's a lecturer in the Department of Environment and Society at Paul Smith's College of the Adirondacks. Allison Konecki and Alex Wegman joining us, both with Rochester roots, now living in California, living through not only the fires, but the last couple of weeks of bizarre dark orange skies, smoke haze, and a tremendous amount of disruption this summer. We're talking about all of these intertwined issues. And when we come back, we're going to ask all three of our guests about whether we've run out of time to sort of be understanding about it, and of whether the kids that Joe's talking about, who are soon to be adults, are about to become very angry with the adults in their lives. We're going to talk about that next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, the CEO of Wells Fargo was asked, how come you don't hire more people of color? He responded, well, there's just not a very big pool of black talent to recruit from. That comment sparked a countrywide discussion about where they're looking, how they're recruiting, and more. And we bring it to Connections on Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So Dr. Henderson was talking about the book on teaching climate change and the way we maybe underestimate kids in particular in their understanding of what's going on and the expectation they have that the world that we're leaving for them and their kids and their grandkids isn't sort of irretrievably going in a certain direction. And Joe, I'll start with you. I want to ask Allison and Alex about this too. I find an argument from Adam Frank, an astrophysicist at the University of Rochester, pretty compelling to a point. He has argued that, for the most part, climate change is not our fault. And what he means is, of course, it's our fault. But when a species gains sentience and intelligence and starts to build its society and gains an understanding and all of the evolutionary things that have happened, that species grows and populates, it's going to consume more resources. That is a natural course of events. It's going to seek more ways to grow, to build, to consume ever more resources. And all of those things are sort of natural. And eventually, there may be enough scientific understanding to say, whoa, okay, we can do this, but there is a cost. And he said, you know, don't blame the species of humans for consuming resources, but blame us if we don't ever come out of our infancy and we don't learn the lessons of what science is telling us. And I think I find that pretty compelling, but I also think we are very close to the point where kids especially are just going to be furious if we don't see significant action here, because we're starting to see, as you say, not just the margins of society, and we should care about everything, but we're seeing the impact just about everywhere. And I wonder if you think we've passed that point. Do you think kids and young adults are pretty angry right now?
Before I get to the angry question, I'm still processing Frank's argument and how kind of utterly devoid of politics it is. I mean, I just published a piece maybe last year about how we teach climate change, to a point I agree with him, right? Like, humans have industrialized society and we live in a complex world, but like, climate change is fundamentally an artifact of colonialism. It's that some nations have industrialized or, quote, developed on the backs of other nations. Not everybody contributes to climate change equally. I'm looking at a report from Oxfam that just came out that said the world's richest 1% caused double the CO2 emissions of the poorest 50%. So I hear something like that from Frank, and I just think, like, maybe scientists aren't the ones who should be communicating about the issues around climate change anymore. There's fundamentally an issue of injustice that needs to be discussed here, it's telling, I think, that in the richest nation in the world, we are the only nation in the world that has one political party that is organized around climate science denial. Why is that, right? Is it this just that people don't understand, or is it that that is how power reproduces itself? Are there interests at stake here in terms of why people would continue to do this? And I think what I'm seeing young people, and I include myself here, right? I'm kind of in the beginning of the millennial generation, is waking up to this, like, oh, this is actually about power and kind of needs to be understood at the level of political power. For years as a kid, we sat through these education lessons around, like, well, just consume differently or use fewer straws or recycle. Won't that be great? And we all, like, I think it's pretty clear now to many of us that that was all kind of junk and there are much bigger issues at play. I don't know. I think that anger, you asked about anger and rage, and I've spent the last I don't know actually how hopeful I am anymore that we will actually deal with this given the way this country is going. I think that anger could go into a couple of directions. We could, you know, have a kind of righteous anger, righteous indignation or something where that provokes us to make a better world. But, you know, that anger could go in other places too. I mean, you're seeing out west specifically the rise of kind of vigilante movements and kind of eco-fascist responses to climate change too. I don't know, you know, whoever harnesses that anger, I think is going to be influential.
Oof.
It's not pleasant. I wish I had something like more hopeful to say, but as a young person I just feel like the institutions of this country are stacked against actually solving any of our problems. And I think until we get serious about thinking through reforming some of those institutions, I don't see how we deal with this issue.
Alex, are you concerned that your 4 and your 2-year-old are going to grow up in a society and kind of look around them and feel that anger that things were allowed to go in the direction they went?
I'm a millennial, and my sister is 8 years younger than I am. So I even have the sample of someone in her early 20s who is already showing some pretty pretty deep angst about feeling powerless to change the minds and motivate the people older than her. It comes out in one-on-one conversations with family members and family friends who just are not on board with doing what needs to be done politically in order to move the needle. And I imagine that my kids will get right on that train as well. I'm right there with her. I'm also, I have a spinal cord injury and I'm a wheelchair user. And so a lot of these issues impact me in ways they don't impact the average person. And it feels bleak and I feel angry and frustrated a lot of the time. And I'm trying not to pass on a feeling of hopelessness to my kids. We try to harness that into useful action we can take, but it is very challenging.
Hmm. Allison, as maybe the biggest optimist left on the panel here, what buoys that for you? And do you feel it eroded at times?
I definitely feel it eroded at times. I think what Alex said about trying to be optimistic just for her children to instill hope. I think that's just where I come from in terms of feeling optimistic is more because I feel for myself, if I don't have that optimism, I then feel absolute hopeless. And then what action can be taken from there, or how can I, you know, keep going? And so I like to spread that feeling. But I will also say many times it's very difficult. I don't know why climate justice is a political thing. It affects everyone. So hearing that and knowing that, like what Joe said, the institutions are stacked against solving this. And there are definitely times when I throw up my hands and feel like there is no way because of the systems in place. But again, I guess if I keep that optimism, it allows me to not just settle with things as being the way they are and to feel like there are people working and there are things that can be done. So I guess that's the place I'm coming from with the optimism there. Just trying to show that, yes, it's not a political thing. It affects us all. And we need to enact policies that will make a difference.
Well, and in our last 90 seconds or so, Joe, we heard Noam Chomsky talking this week about his sort of lack of optimism that absent significant systemic change in how we set up society, that a whole lot's going to change. You're starting to lose that hope that a whole lot is going to change. Do you see it requiring massive economic system change, or do you see sort of any incrementalism? Because the incrementalists, of which there are many in Congress, claim that we can take step by step to get where we need to go, whether it's 2030 or otherwise. You don't strike me as an incrementalist anymore.
I feel like I have been listening to incrementalists make incrementalist arguments for I don't even know how long, and I just wonder if they incrementalism doesn't strike me as a kind of vision that people can get behind towards transformation that allows for human and ecological flourishing, and I don't know. I don't know that we have the politicians that we need to get us there right now. And maybe they're somewhere down the line. You can look at like what the Sunrise Movement just did with bringing Ed Markey across the line. Markey now is talking in very different ways about climate change, and there needs to be way more of that. And frankly, there needs to be Republicans who start to engage with this issue. Younger Republican voters are overwhelmingly already there. They don't have a party that represents them. We need to get caught up to that. I don't think our politics are there yet.
Well, I wish we had a little bit of more buoyant note to conclude the program, but we need to have this conversation, and there's a lot more to say as we go forward. Dr. Joe Henderson, lecturer in the Department of Environment and Society at Paul Smith College of the Adirondacks. I do hope it's a beautiful day there for you, and I do appreciate you being on the program. Thanks, Joe.
Yep. Thank you, Evan.
Always. Our thanks to Allison Konecki, who joining us from the West Coast, and thank you very much for the insight.
Thanks for having me.
Alex Wegman, the same. Thanks, and good luck to your family.
Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Allie Larkin for joining us earlier this hour. Megan Mack, the producer and the engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.